You are listening to Angel Insights, brought to you by Syndicate Room. This is the show that delves inside the world of early stage and angel investing to reveal the tips, tactics and strategies of some of the world's best early stage investors. And I'm so thrilled to have Sarah Thomas, principal at Maven Ventures, joining me today. Sarah is a seed stage investor in consumer startups at Maven, where she works with 20 plus companies in the Maven portfolio and manages the mentor network they have in place there. Prior to joining Maven, Sarah ran early stage startup programming at the Idea Village, an entrepreneurship engine in New Orleans. And while there, she built and managed a team of over 40 employees, contractors and mentors to deliver direct services to over 1,200 companies. An enthusiastic supporter of entrepreneurs herself, Sarah also launched her own business in 2014 to help founders and investors launch and build networks that help startups thrive. She shares some of these incredible experiences in her TED talk of building her business. And if you'd like to read the accompanying article to this episode, then head over to syndicateroom.com, where you can find our Investor Learning Academy. But now it's time to welcome Sarah and to dive into the show. So ladies and gents, I'm delighted to welcome Sarah Thomas, principal at Maven Ventures. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Now, I'd love to start off today by hearing a little about your background and how you made it into the tech and the investing world.
Yes, absolutely. It's really, I would say, a journey of personal passion for me. I originally found my way to the West Coast in 2007 for business school at Stanford. And my entire journey kind of coming there, and the reason that I was at Stanford is I personally believe that there's a massive opportunity at the intersection of for-profit business and social change. And I felt like that was the place where I was going to be able to unlock the ability to have those two areas intersect. And it became pretty clear to me being in the Valley that entrepreneurship is that. And I still believe entrepreneurship is the single greatest opportunity our generation has to have a massive impact on the world. So that's sort of what started me on that path. And so I spent all of my time basically since business school trying to find a way to help be kind of a catalyst for entrepreneurs and help them to better build their businesses, and have built my own skills with the idea of how can I become invaluable to early stage founders. So that took me on a journey all around the country. I ran early stage programming at an organization called the Idea Village in New Orleans, with the mission of really helping to restart some of the businesses and kind of post Hurricane Katrina business renaissance taking place in New Orleans. And that led me to launch my own business. So I had my own consulting and advising practice that I ran out here in the Bay Area, where I would work with people all around the country and all around the world that wanted to better work with startups. And how can I figure out what are the problems that every company has, every founder has, every startup has, and have the resources ready to help them tackle those. So that's really been kind of my personal mission and vision. And as I was doing more and more of that work, I started to meet a lot of venture investors, one of whom is Jim Scheinman, who's the founder at Maven, and started working with him to help really build out Maven's incubator offering. And pretty quickly after we started working together, I realized that it was a great fit, you know, longer term, and joined the team as an investor and also to run our incubator.
And you mentioned there about being invaluable as an early stage investor. I'm intrigued as to kind of, you know, lots of VCs are trying to differentiate themselves with value adds. What would you say is your value add and that makes you invaluable as an investor?
I think the most important thing is that we're truly the first line of defense for our founders, and we're really in the boat with them, and we're not afraid to roll up our sleeves and get to work. So I've had weeks where I've spent 5 hours or more with one particular founder, really getting into the weeds of their business. We have 23 portfolio companies, you know, so you can imagine that that starts to get, that can be a lot, but we want to be the first person our founders come to and really help them become an extension of their founding team, whether it's helping them with their marketing and messaging, their product, their very, very early growth strategies, helping them connect them to the right employees, helping them with recruiting, whether it's finding the right recruiters or the right individuals to join their team. Of course, fundraising is a huge aspect of that, though we really focus on what we like to call kind of a private demo day, where we handpick the right, you know, investors to connect our founders to and connect them at the time that's right for them. And we don't let them go meet until they're ready. So they have their deck in order, they have their vision, they have the right numbers. So since we spend so much time hands-on with them, I think that that's really what allows us to be in that different class. The second thing I'll mention is that we're, you know, 100% focused on early stage consumer software. It's a pretty specialized focus, and not all funds do that. But for us, having that differentiation makes a big difference.
And I'm intrigued there. At such an early stage and being the first line of call for your entrepreneurs, where do you stand on the kind of investor versus friend relationship between you and the operators? I mean, should investors be friends with the portfolio companies? What's your take on this?
You know, that's a great question, and not something I've really pondered a lot about. I'll say that I have most of my founders' numbers in my cell phone, and we might communicate over text just as easily as we might communicate over email. At the same time, those really, for our fund, tend to be professional relationships. But you have to understand also that the ebbs and flows of a founder's life also kind of come into play with their own businesses. And that happens with investors. We have lives as well. And so you start to kind of live with your founders and sort of understand maybe they've had a death in the family, or they've broken up after a serious relationship, or have to break up with a co-founder. You know, so there are personal issues that are really interwoven there. I'll say that in that instance, we have a personal relationship with those founders. And I think you have to be able to connect them on a personal level. Though most of what we do, really, I would view us as a business advisor, but we're all kind of human and you have to have that individual personal connection.
And I'm really intrigued by the kind of evolution of portfolio company to investor communication. And you mentioned that you have all their phone numbers in your phone. So is that how you primarily communicate them? Do you think that kind of first-hand dialogue is much more personable than the cold email system?
We do a lot of emails. I'll say, actually, in my life as a venture investor at a very small firm, I get more email in this job than I've ever had in my entire life, including, you know, I spent 3 years as a strategy consultant at Deloitte, you know, working with huge companies all over the U.S. And I've never had so much email. So we do a lot of email investing for more kind of day-to-day stay in touch and, you know, small updates, quick notes, things like that, sharing, you know, articles or something we might have found out about a competitor or something like that. And then there's a lot more formal, you know, the monthly investor updates that we might be on with other investors, reviews of their decks and pitches and their monthly numbers. You know, so there are things that are more formal, though a lot of it just is kind of comes and goes in the normal kind of day of operations. And we try to be available whenever our founders need us.
And you mentioned there about your time spent outside of Silicon Valley and in New Orleans. So what's your views on kind of the location-centric need for startups? Do you think we need to be in the tech hubs? It doesn't have to be Silicon Valley, but London, Berlin, Tokyo maybe. Do you think we need to, or can you operate a very successful company with ease outside?
That's a great question. And historically have focused our investment in Silicon Valley. You know, I was here and I left and went to other markets and learned so much, but I came back because I know that this is the best place to be, you know, in this industry. And this is where our investments are focused. However, we just did our first investment in a New York company. We also look in Los Angeles. We look in Toronto. We look in Tel Aviv. You know, so we're open to some other markets where we think that the kind of early seeds of consumer investing are there. This is still right now, I think, the best place to do it. But I think there is opportunity in other markets. And I think that one of the things that those founders can do to set themselves apart, you know, number one is they need to build their networks. And if there's not enough capital, you know, from Cincinnati, for instance, if there's not enough capital in Cincinnati, I'm constantly going back to the area and helping people just understand this is what it's like to raise money. This is the stage you're at. This is the competition you have in the market versus where other startups are, kind of where you stand on that spectrum. And people need to build those networks and kind of have those connections so that they can get that feedback and always be open to, this is something that I think for companies here as well as in other markets, you have to be receptive to that feedback and be just a sponge and willing to take that expertise and learn from it when you can. And I think those opportunities are a little bit more limited in other places.
I'm really intrigued by that being receptive to feedback, because a lot of founders are so inundated now with mentorship offers and advice and feedback from investors and mentors, as we said there. So how can you kind of combat that investor whiplash and not get bogged down by the enormity of it all and any disheartening feedback you might get?
Yeah, we do a presentation pretty frequently on the top 10 things you need to be successful in consumer. And remember, one of them is avoid mentor whiplash. So it's a real issue and something that we talk about. I think the best thing a founder can do is identify someone who knows their specific business. That's why we focus on consumer. So if somebody comes to me and they want my help, or they want me to connect them to an investor that does, you know, enterprise SaaS, or that does, you know, medical devices or some sort of, you know, highly technical infrastructure business, I just don't know how to help them, and people shouldn't listen to my advice. But I think that, you know, finding that investor that really has been in your shoes and that knows your specific type of business is important, and work with them. So find those advisors and solicit feedback from them. You're the CEO, so you have to make the choice, and you may not agree with your investors and you may do something different. But find the people that you trust that have experience in your area and rely on those people to give you the feedback.
And you said about founders building their network just a bit back. How would you say founders can kind of successfully establish a good network around them, both of fellow founders and of mentors?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think it really starts with your personal network, right? And so who do you know that's started a company before that might be connected to an investor? If you're outside of the Valley, I've seen amazing entrepreneurship ecosystems really emerge, and they're easy to get plugged into, to just become somebody that attends those events and gets to know those people and is really active and kind of contributing back to the ecosystem. If you're here specifically, then you likely are, you know, just a few degrees away from most, you know, from most investors. And so really understanding in your own personal network, who are those connections, and figuring out how to cultivate those in a way that's valuable for them. You know, and you're not asking too much, and you're asking something those people can deliver. And you're always willing to kind of give something back to them.
And then Maven also runs the incubator.
We do.
So I'm really intrigued then as to what you define makes a really successful incubator. Mm-hmm. What are the determinants?
I think for an incubator, and I've worked with incubators, that's been a big focus of what I've done over the last 8 years. And I think an incubator has to know their client, which is a startup. So you have to know the companies that you're working with. What are their biggest problems? And can you reliably gather the resources that they need to help them overcome those? So not just being able to get companies to want to work with you, being able to select good ones, but do you truly know what the issues are that they're facing? And can you help them address those? And so that's what I think of. Am I always gathering the right resources to help identify an obstacle before my founders even know it's there and remove it from their way? You know, so helping them kind of overcome that stuff before, you know, before it really is an impediment to their business. So I think that that's really important. Our incubator is really different. We don't do a demo day. We don't do a batch. It's a rolling admission program, and we become an extension of that founding team. So we work with them for 6 to 9 months. We're an extension of their founding team. We do everything that, you know, from the early stage messaging to helping them with their fundraising pitch to building their team, articulating their vision, until they've gone on to raise their Series A or a little bit later, and then at which point they have other advisors that kind of step in to that particular role. So I think ours is different in that it has that type of structure, and we also focus 100% on consumers. So I think that sense of differentiation is really important.
And what do you think of the benefits of that kind of open-endedness? I mean, is it Parkinson's theory, which says when you allocate a specific time to something, you'll complete it in that time? Does the open-endedness lend to startups in terms of creative freedom, or does it actually just allow them to carry on more?
You know, unfortunately for seed-stage startups, nothing is open-ended, right? You're going to have to raise more capital, and you're going to have to get your business in a point where you can raise that capital. And that is one of our big goals. Can we help you build a business to achieve your next major funding milestone? You know, and that has to be a huge focus. We've been 100% successful to date in being able to do that because we identify those companies, we know what their issues are, and we help gather the resources that...
So what's the vetting process then to get into the incubator at Maven? Mm-hmm. What do you kind of go, bang, they've got it?
Yeah, we have a you know, pretty extensive what we call, you know, our diligence memo. A lot of funds have that. For us, the first thing that we start with is the vision we're fighting for. And do we think this company has a meaningful vision that is going to impact consumers' lives at massive scale? And if we don't believe that that exists, and also share and have some passion for that vision, the conversation typically doesn't continue further. Once we feel like we're excited about that vision, that sort of is the domino effect that all of those other items fall into line about the team and the CEO founder. Are they coachable? Do they have the expertise? Do they have the passion? Do they have a technical co-founder, or is the CEO technical? You know, so the team comes after that. The market opportunity, is this something that has venture scale returns? You know, so it goes on to a list of, you know, a bunch of other things that we look at. But first and foremost, we start with that vision.
So two questions here. Venture scale returns. Absolutely. When you have a smaller fund, do you have more flexibility in terms of the companies that then you select, because you don't need the multi-billion dollar exits that your Sequoias do?
To some degree, in some strategies, that is probably true. And there are a lot of micro funds that will invest in, you know, 100 or more companies out of their fund, and then they're really looking for singles and doubles. We keep a very concentrated strategy. So our fund one had 22 companies in it. Our fund two will have somewhere between 16 and 18 companies. So we really are looking. We believe every one of our companies can have $1 billion exit. And those are the type of ideas that we're going for. That's our concentrated strategy. That's what we know how to do. And since we spend so much time with those companies, we just can't invest in 100.
Mm-hmm. And then final question for we dive into a quick fire.
Yeah.
I have to ask, if we're talking about incubators and accelerators, Sam Altman's post on incubator hopping, what do we think on it? I mean, do you have that, if you've been to an incubator, you should be further down the line already? Or how do you assess the multiple incubator startups?
Yeah. You know, of course, like, I get it. Like, of course, YC wants to be the incubator of choice for everybody, and they want people to come to them, and they want them
to come to them first. Just come to us.
Of course. Like, at least they're being honest and putting it out there, right? So, of course, we know that's your strategy, and I applaud them for going after it. And they've built an amazing franchise, an amazing brand, and have funded some pretty incredible companies. So, kudos to them for what they've done. When I think about a founder in a specific company, they really have to decide incubator by incubator. We have funded companies before and after most major programs, including YC. So we've had people in our incubator before them, we've funded people after them, and that applies to a pretty wide range of incubators. So I think the founders have to decide, what am I getting out of this specific incubator at this specific time? And network and investor intros are not enough anymore, and that used to be the game. You're going to give me a network, you're going to give me investor intros, you're going to give me demo day, and there's so many people doing that now that I don't believe that's enough. And so each founder has to say, like, what about this specific network? Who's the specific partner at that incubator I'm going to be working with? You know, I think there's a lot more that goes into that decision now than it used to just be, I got to get to demo day and have the pop evaluation because of brand.
Mm-hmm. And then I'd love to dive into a quick fire round now.
Let's do it.
So your favorite book and why?
My favorite book is The Alchemist. I read it probably once a year. I think the idea that the whole world is like conspiring to help you make your dreams become a reality is pretty powerful. And for me personally, the idea that I get to work with people every day that are seeking some sort of like amazing vision and people that are fully invested in what they're doing, that they're seeking something that's greater than themselves. I love that. That makes me tick. That makes them tick. So the book really speaks to me.
And then underhyped and overhyped, which sectors do you identify?
Overhyped, I'll give you, it's not a sector, it's maybe more of a trend. Overhyped, Uber for X.
Okay.
I don't think, you know, do I need one specific company that delivers me every specific little thing at any specific time? I don't believe that to be true. So I'm going to say, I think that's overhyped. Underhyped, I think consumer healthcare opportunities. I think there's a lot of trends. That's a big area of focus that we're looking at. My background is in healthcare prior to getting into venture. And the idea that now consumers are interacting with their health in a way that they never have before, it's not just about wearables and it's not just about new insurance products, but what are the new kind of emerging opportunities for consumers directly interacting with their healthcare.
And then one character aspect of entrepreneurs that you most kind of look for and excite you?
I love founders that will break through a brick wall if they have to. So just total, utter resilience, tenacity, determination. People that say, I will get this done, kind of come hell or high water, and they do. I think that, to me, just makes me excited to help grow a business.
And then your favorite blog or newsletter?
I read Mattermark every day. So I think it's a good, I mean, it kind of is a... means I get to read all the blogs, right? Because they serve us a lot of great content.
Daily.
Yeah, I read Mattermark every day.
And then advice to individuals looking to enter VC?
I think the first, it's a very network-driven business. And I didn't realize that until I truly sat in a venture investor's shoes and realized the power of my own network to unlock and help make my companies and our firm successful. And so you have to cultivate that network and those real kind of true authentic relationships. And I think the second piece of that is just become invaluable to founders. Like, you need, at the end of the day, you need your founders to say, without Sarah, this wouldn't have happened. You know, without Maven, this wouldn't have happened. And I think that's for people getting into VC very early on. How can you from day one start to help those companies in a way that they're going to remember?
And then finally, your most recent investment and why you said yes.
Yes. Our most recent investment is a company called Homemade. It allows people to buy and sell home cooked food from people right directly in their neighborhood. So if you want to buy, or if you're a stay-at-home mom making a tray of lasagna, half of that feeds your family, half of it goes to other people in your apartment building or in your community. They now can buy that directly from you. If you're a cook or a chef that has a nightly job at a restaurant, but you want to do your own thing, maybe you cook really interesting ethnic cuisine, you can now do that through the Homemade app and your neighbors can buy directly from you. So I think it's an amazing way for people to have kind of healthier home-cooked food in a really affordable way that kind of unlocks this new opportunity to build a community through food that hasn't existed before. So we love that idea. We've been looking for this vision for a long time, and we think the Homemade team has a really amazing opportunity and a vision that we haven't seen yet.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for giving up the time today to join us on the show. It's been such a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks for having me.
And if you enjoyed today's show with Sarah, then head on over to our Investor Learning Academy at syndicateroom.com, where you can find all the resources and articles from today's episode and from past episodes. And if you are loving the show, then do follow us on Twitter at syndicateroom. And we'd also like to remind you that early stage investing is risky. Therefore, please ensure that you engage in the proper due diligence prior to making the investments. It's been an absolute pleasure bringing you today's episode, and we hope you enjoy it. And we look forward to bringing you next week's show.